from the North Carolina Reading Service, Indie Week. John Federson is reading for our blind and print-impaired listeners from the current issue, dated April 21st, 2021. And folks, we found a new source for our theme music today, a very specialized service. They call themselves the Indie Week Radio Theme People, LLC. And we sure hope you folks improve, because they're very economical. And launching right into news now from North Carolina, written by Jeff West, Identity Politics. State lawmakers are pushing legislation that would turn online impersonation into a felony offense. A West Texas man hijacked his ex-girlfriend's email address to create a fake profile of her on a dating website. In Utah, a policeman was suspended after someone posted racist remarks on a Facebook profile created to look like his wife's account. Meanwhile, a Louisiana man stole a stranger's photos to pretend to be a woman on social media as a way to lure women into sending him illicit photos. West Texas and Louisiana men were both arrested under state laws prohibiting someone from impersonating another online with the intent to do harm. No such law exists in Utah, however, where law enforcement could do little to stop the defamation. Texas and Louisiana are the outliers. Online impersonation, when coupled with malicious intent, is illegal in only a handful of states, but it could be outlawed soon in North Carolina, too. House Bill 341 would make it a felony, punishable by up to 25 months in jail, for a person to use email, text messages, or a fake social media account to impersonate someone with the intent of harming, intimidating, threatening, or defrauding. Last week, the bill passed the House unanimously, 118-0, with two absentees, en route to a hearing before the Senate Rules Committee. The bill's primary sponsor, Republican Representative Donna White of Clayton, says she filed the bill after a conversation with two constituents, a young married couple, whose reputation and small business had been damaged by someone impersonating them on social media. White says two people created a bogus Facebook page in the likeness of the business owners, then posted messages on the page that made it appear as though they were racist. The imposters also created another fictitious Facebook account to comment on those racist remarks as a way to spread them across social media. She says they were kind of doing two things. They were impersonating, then they were responding to their own impersonation. The business owners reported the scam to law enforcement, who were willing to help and had identified the perpetrators. White says, but they don't have the teeth to do anything because there was no law. Word of the racist remarks from what appeared to be the business owners started spreading in the community, she says, and it soon had real-world consequences. They were really losing business badly. Under the proposal, stealing someone's information to hijack their online identity or creating a completely bogus profile using another person's image would both be criminal offenses when coupled with malicious intent. The language of the North Carolina bill mimics statutes already adopted in at least 10 other states which have criminalized online impersonation uniquely from other cyber crimes, such as identity theft, according to data from the National Conference of State Legislatures. The origin of e-personation laws can be traced back to the 2006 suicide of a Missouri teenager named Megan Meyer, who was duped by the MySpace profile of what appeared to be an attractive boy named Josh Evans. The two teens flirted for weeks until Evans eventually turned on Meyer and wrote, "The world would be a better place without you." She later hung herself. An investigation revealed there was no Josh Evans. The MySpace profile was created by the 47-year-old mother of one of Meyer's former friends as a way to retaliate for Meyer allegedly spreading rumors about her daughter. The mother, Lori Drew, was convicted under a federal computer fraud statute, but the conviction was overturned on appeal after a federal court ruled the law did not apply to Drew's actions. Meyer's death and Drew's acquittal received widespread media attention and led to state lawmakers across the country racing to criminalize cyberbullying against minors. But state law hasn't kept pace with this new type of online harassment, says Senate Majority Whip Jim Perry, Republican from Lenoir County. Perry, a member of the Senate Rules Committee that will consider White's bill, also introduced legislation this session to bar online impersonation. Similar to White's story, Perry says he was motivated to author the bill following a disturbing conversation with a troubled constituent who had a family member whose life was turned upside down by an imposter. Perry says a third party created some social media accounts in this person's name, and they did some very vile things and really brought up a lot of very inflammatory subjects in the most inflammatory means possible. The fake account spread on social media, he says, quote, and you had hundreds and thousands of people who were upset with this person, who did nothing. The victim received death threats and was concerned for their life, he says. After, as he listened to the story, Perry says he realized the person who created the fictitious account had found a loophole in state law that needed closing. This can do a lot of damage to someone. Joseph Kennedy, University of North Carolina, a Chapel Hill law professor who specializes in cybercrime, says there is some disagreement in the legal community over how lawmakers should handle e-personations. He said in an email to the Indy, some believe that such conduct can be addressed more simply through existing criminal fraud statutes. It's a matter of debate among legal scholars whether special computer crimes should be created to deal with conduct that existing crimes already cover. One issue is whether using a specially created computer crime clarifies the law or needlessly complicates it. But the victims in White and Perry's districts turned to legislators only after learning law enforcement could do a little to stop the activity. Perry says the law needs updating to keep pace with technology. And he says, there's a warm blanket of anonymity out there that makes people do some really bold and nasty things. It's such a gray area. The law didn't contemplate issues such as this. Next, from Hannah Mayo, writing about Durham, trying times. Asian American business owners describe fear. Seated in the back of his Durham restaurant, Kenny Wong recounts fleeing Vietnam at 8 years old as one of hundreds and thousands of boat people, refugees who left the country by sea after the Vietnam War. He and his family spent 7 days on the Pacific Ocean with more than 50 people on a tiny vessel surviving hunger, dehydration, and an encounter with pirates. I don't think anything can get me down, Wong says, but lately it's been difficult to stay afloat. Wong opened Secrets Pho and Noodle Bar last July after years of wanting to run his own Vietnamese restaurant. When he signed the lease in September 2019, there was no way to predict that a global coronavirus pandemic would ravage the economy and devastate the food service industry. On top of the day-to-day challenges of operating a restaurant within the restrictions, Secrets was recently broken into twice within 1 month, first on February 7th and again on March 3rd. The restaurant was already losing up to about $1,000 a day, Wong says. Having to shut down for repairs for roughly a week didn't help. And Secrets manager Hennessy Asaro said it did take a serious emotional toll on us. And then when the second one happened, we were asking, why again? And why us again? Durham small businesses have seen an uptick in commercial burglaries amid the pandemic, local crime data show. But for Asian-owned establishments, the attack also come amid a rise in discrimination and violence targeting Asians and Asian Americans during the pandemic. The national advocacy group Stop AAPI Hate received 3,795 reports of hate incidents towards Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders from March 19, 2020 to February the 28th of 2021. 35% of which occurred at businesses. A shooting spree targeting three Asian businesses in Atlanta in March that left 8 people dead including six Asian women, has only heightened the sense of fear in Asian American communities. Janet Lee, owner of Zen Fish Poke Bar, says it's definitely frightening. The eatery has three locations in the Triangle area, one of which is a few doors down from Secrets on 9th Street in Durham. Lee says there was an attempted burglary at Zen Fish's 9th Street location around the same time Secrets was broken into in February. She purchased pepper spray for each store and stopped carrying cash on site, and says, "You're kind of in a battle with yourself, thinking if it is targeted towards Asians or if it just happens to be a lot like a lot of other break-ins. Having someone break in to your restaurant or business is horrible, whether it's Asian hate or not. But if it is Asian hate, it's even worse. They're not only targeting your business, but your race because of who you are." Durham Police Spokesman Lamont Miner says the department is not currently investigating any incidents at Asian-owned businesses as potential hate crimes, and said in an email, "We have no reason to believe that there is a specific target to Asian restaurants at this time." Mayor Steve Shule noted that the Durham Police Department has worked closely with a group of Asian restaurant owners over the last several years after several Asian-owned eateries were targeted for robberies. Durham Chinese restaurant owner Hong Zheng was shot and killed during an armed attack in 2018. Shule said in an email, "We know that there is a wave of anti-Asian violence in our country now, and we cannot and will not accept that in Durham. We welcome and embrace our Asian communities in Durham and will do everything in our power to protect them." Lawrence Yu, owner of the Durham restaurant Sushioki and lead pastor at Waypoint Church, recalls experiencing at least two racist attacks in the past year. In one incident, he was driving home after closing Sushioki for the night when the driver in front of him stopped their car and proceeded to shout racial slurs and profanities at him. Growing up, the son of Korean immigrant small business owners, Yu says robberies were a constant fear, even an expectation. He says people used to think that Asians would keep a lot more cash, which is just not the case anymore. "I used to be at home waiting and praying for my parents to get home safe after every night after they closed out the restaurant. I've been living with that fear for a while." Apart from burglaries, many Asian-owned establishments began experiencing the effects of the pandemic long before statewide lockdowns last March. National news outlets reported that some Asian small businesses across the country saw drops in revenue early in 2020 amid concerns about the coronavirus outbreak originating in China, despite few reported COVID cases in the U.S. at the time and no evidence of transmission through food. Advocates say anti-Asian sentiments have been stoked by the rhetoric of leaders like former President Donald Trump, who continually referred to the coronavirus in racialized terms such as Chinese virus and Kung flu. Heidi Kim, director of UNC at Chapel Hill's Asian American Center, says, "If you look at comments online, there are people who for a long time would not go to a Chinese restaurant. There probably are people who still aren't going to Asian restaurants or supermarkets." Many Asian immigrant small business owners have also difficulty applying for COVID relief from government loans like the Paycheck Protection Program or other institutional resources due to language barriers, says Ricky Leung, senior director of programs for the advocacy group North Carolina Asian Americans Together. And he says, "A lot of issues our communities run into during the pandemic aren't necessarily something that's unique to the pandemic." Wong, owner of Secrets, hasn't been able to apply for PPP loans because the restaurant wasn't operating before February 2020, an eligibility requirement of the program. Wong says, "It's tough. Right now I'm using all of my resources. It's really difficult to raise money. Sometimes people ask, 'How are you doing? How do you stay open at this time?' I don't know whether I should laugh or cry." These days, Wong is focused on keeping Secret's door open and his 10 employees paid, healthy, and safe. He wants his restaurant to inspire his two children, who are 12 and 15 years old, and believes in his mission of serving the Durham community with healthy, traditional Vietnamese cuisine, from a bowl of pho to banh mi to his personal favorite, egg noodles. He says, I just have to take it every day. Every morning is a second chance. Now, our next article today actually does not come from the print edition, which is printed the day before I read it. But this came out today, and it was also by Tomasi McDonald. And it's titled, Deportation Order Rescinded. Juana Tobar Ortega, a native of Guatemala, lived for 4 years in a Greensboro church to avoid deportation, but that's over now. Ortega returned home to her family in Asheboro this week after a deportation order was rescinded by a stay of removal issued by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, according to Siembra NC, a Latinx advocacy group which operates in the Triangle area. Ortega said in a press release, I want to thank God and all of the people who have helped us. I wish blessings to everyone who has supported me and my family. I'm so glad to be able to return home. She managed to avoid immigration officials by seeking sanctuary at St. Barnabas Episcopal Church in Greensboro. Kelly Morales, Siembra NC's executive director, said Ortega was the first immigrant to seek sanctuary in the Southeast. She began her stay with that church in May of 2017 and continued, Juana has been a beacon of courage for immigrant women across the country for the last 4 years. In a press release, she said, she has worked tirelessly all this time to support local and national immigrant rights, organizing at the same time as she was continuing to practice her craft as a seamstress to help support her family. I'm glad she can finally return home and rest, and I hope the administration will continue to use its authority to grant stays of removal to North Carolinians like her, hundreds of whom still have active orders of removal, which could result in needless family separation. The documentary film, Santuario, chronicled part of the time Ortega spent living in the Greensboro church, where she fled after immigration authorities issued her deportation order, during a routine annual check-in at the Charlotte ICE office in February of 2017. She had been granted a limited permit to work in the United States. Morales said Ortega's decision inspired six other North Carolinians to seek sanctuary at other houses of worship across the state, all of whom sought her counsel first. As previously reported by Indy, seven of the 36 immigrants living in sanctuary in the United States as of January 2018 were in North Carolina. Ortega is the last person seeking sanctuary in the state to receive a stay of removal since the Biden administration took office in January, according to Siembra NC. While she was in sanctuary, Ortega's eldest daughter, Leslie, gave birth to a son. Nearly a year and a half later, she finally will be able to visit her grandson at home. Leslie Molina, Ortega's daughter and a DACA recipient, that's the Dreamers, said in the release, God has been good to us, and the day we've been waiting for has finally arrived. We're so grateful to be able to return to a normal life as a family. Morales said, for now, the Guatemalan woman wants to enjoy being reunited with her family. She and her family are currently declining interview requests and request privacy as they readjust to life at home. All right, now back to our print edition Orange County article by Sarah Pequeño, Closer to Home. No one wants to talk about it, but homelessness can't be wheeled out of sight. It's visible in the sleeping bags and bags of clothes tucked into corners of Franklin Street and Chapel Hill, but it exists outside the periphery, too. Even for people who work within the community, it's uncomfortable. Corey Root says, I feel discomfort. when I see someone experiencing homelessness who's panhandling or that kind of thing, because I know in my heart that it's not right. In our society, we have enough to go around, but for whatever reason, that's not happening, and that makes me feel uncomfortable. Root is the manager of the Orange County Partnership to End Homelessness, part of the county government that oversees how we address homelessness in our community. In 2020, the partnership began four programs that shifted the way local government interacts with homelessness. The group's mantra is housing first. This concept is fairly new, but growing in popularity. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, has started to use this method instead of the transitional housing model they have recommended for years. The issue with transitional housing, Root says, is that it isn't a permanent solution. And by HUD's definition, folks in transitional housing are still homeless. He says, what we would see with this transitional housing is the long length of time that people are experiencing homelessness. Say, 3 months in the shelter, 2 years in a transitional housing program. That's 2 years and 3 months that you've been experiencing homelessness, that you're not in your space where you make the rules and where you feel comfortable. This also gets at a big issue in Orange County, Root says. Shelters in the county are almost always full and have long wait lists. You can't show up day of and get a bed for the night. There are also people who have lived in these shelters for years without a permanent housing solution. In April 2020, the partnership created a housing helpline for people to call, a housing access coordinator who works with landlords to find permanent housing, and Rapid Rehousing, which offers aid so folks can get into housing as soon as possible. From April to December, the partnership received more than 9,900 calls and 7,000 emails from people on the verge of homelessness or already homeless. Root says, we see it over and over and over again. Once folks are able to get into housing, a lot of other things are able to just sort of settle out a little bit. That stress and constant trauma is able to settle down so that folks are able to work on other things. Another issue that has plagued Orange County for years is the lack of a street outreach program with long-term connections. One has existed within the Chapel Hill Police Department since the early 1970s, around the time public housing began losing funding. The outreach team's supervisor, Megan Johnson, says it was one of the first programs in the country. The issue, she says, is that unsheltered people's lives are crises. She says of the help they can offer, that crisis is still going to be there. They still likely don't have anywhere to sleep tonight. That's where the partnership's street outreach, harm reduction and deflection, called SORAD, program comes in. Instead of immediate care, like what's offered by CHPD, they work solely with the unsheltered residents of Orange County. Root says they're on Franklin Street really regularly, out at the campsites, at jail, in the hospital, that kind of thing. They're really out and about. They don't just sit behind a desk and file reports. Their focus is on the long term, making connections with the folks they meet so they feel comfortable speaking with the caseworkers. They ask people if they want help and what they need. If someone doesn't want help, the group doesn't give up. They'll ask again the next time they're out and about. Both SORAD and the CHPD crisis program are alternatives to policing and incarceration. If there isn't an immediate danger, other community members have a safe space to call. But it requires other community members to know the difference between danger and discomfort, Root says, mentioning that folks usually conflate the two. And he says, discomfort's important, and that's something we should listen to and act on, but that doesn't mean that there's danger. All right, this next article by Carmilla Guaglianone, A Bridge Too Far. And I have looked at quite a few videos from this website called 11foot8.com. It's Durham's Can Opener Bridge. The stoplight is red, and the overheight must turn sly and flashes urgently as a semi-truck waits at the intersection. The driver has a moment to consider turning before impact with the railroad bridge above Gregson Street. Instead, they keep going and approach the bridge at a crawl, hesitate, then charge on. Wrong move. The crash on November 13th, 2020, was just one of more than 160 recorded in this very spot. The scars etched onto that bridge protective beam. The beam is the real foe, unmoving and unforgiving. Its scratches are an inventory of human error, of man versus metal, man losing. The bridge at Norfolk Southern Gregson Street underpass is known to the world as the Can Opener, for the merciless way the beam peels the tops off of unsuspecting trucks. To watch it 160-plus times is like seeing a giant hand pull the tab on a can of sardines and seeing the metal curve upward to unveil the prize within. Since 2008, the Can Opener has developed a cult following well beyond Durham. The website 11foot8.com and its YouTube channel, operated by Jürgen Henn as an IT manager for the Duke Center for Autism and Brain Development, have shared videos of the crashes from cameras hand set up at his office in nearby Brightleaf Square and later in a shop kitty-corner to the bridge. Henn, who has worked at Brightleaf Square since 2002, got the idea to start recording the videos after a couple of years of hearing trucks smashing into the beam. His YouTube channel had a slow start, but now has 164,000 followers. And a typical video will get more than 1 million views. To understand the Can Opener, writes Carmela Guaglianone, I watched every video. As I sat in cafes around Durham, I watched hours of scrapes, smashes, and crashes, and cataloged the human error, the reliability of steel, and the fragility of sheet metal and fiberglass. I laughed and gasped and winced. People stared. This is what I learned, spiced with some quotes from police reports that give you a flavor of the action. Vehicle 1 was in the right lane of traffic traveling south on Gregson when it collided with the overhead bridge guard just south of West Peabody. Drivers cause the crashes, but in the videos you don't see the people very much. They exist in the periphery, innocent bystanders shielding themselves from debris, or drivers who jump out of trucks and throw their hats in frustration. The trucks become animated, and the people are minimized to supporting characters. From what I could tell watching all the videos, as well as reading accident reports and news coverage, very few injuries have been reported, and no one has died in the crashes. The majority of the harm seems to be to the driver's pride. While each crash is its own special snowflake, I identified three main types of encounters: the curious cat, the bullet, and the barbershop shave. The curious cat takes a hesitant approach, like a troublemaking feline, and the driver suspects something is amiss, but can't stop themselves from exploring. Their foot barely touching the gas, they ease toward the bridge. Perhaps they believe if they're quiet enough, the can opener won't notice the oversized trailer. Then they hear the unmistakable bang and metallic scrape from above as the beam peels away their roof. Because they've gone slowly, some are able to shift into reverse and delicately extract themselves. Others need to be rescued. The bullet is the most exciting of the can openers. The driver approaches with velocity, seemingly unaware of the trap that lies ahead. The impact causes a whiplash like a dog jerked back by their leash, the cabs sometimes lifted into the air by the impact of the beam. The top layer of aluminum is sometimes guillotined to varying degrees, usually triggering Newton's first law. Objects in motion stay in motion, ensnared where it is crumpled by the equal and opposite force of the wrinkled metal. And then there is the barbershop shave. These trucks almost clear the height requirement and usually make it most of the way without much damage, but they leave with a kiss from the bridge. Debris rains down like rice at a wedding, marking the union. Driver 1 said that his truck is measured at 12.4. Signage for the overpass indicated the clearance is 12.4, 12 feet 4 inches. The North Carolina Department of Transportation has futilely tried to stop the crashes over the years. When I spoke with them, they made it clear there's only so much they can do, as the bridge is technically the property of the North Carolina Railroad Company. Marty Homan, a spokesman at DOT, says, "You know, from our standpoint, we've done everything we can do to help the situation." In 2013, new signs stating the height of the bridge were installed, in addition to a static overhead caution, over height must turn black and yellow sign to make the clearance warnings more visible. 2 hours later, there was a crash. In 2016, traffic lights were added to the overhead warning that forces drivers to stop, stare at the now height-activated electronic over height must turn sign, and ponder their options before they crash into the beam. That day, the camera recorded some successes from the new setups. 2 months later, an XL moving and storage truck crashed into the beam. In 2019, the North Carolina Railroad Company threw the Department of Transportation a bone. It raised the overpass 8 inches to the 12 foot 4 inches. The project was not to prevent damage to trucks, but to level the tracks above. Crews lifted the bridge on hydraulic jacks, regraded the tracks, and placed shims on the old foundation to add height. They also took the opportunity to spruce up the paint job and to accent the bridge's fresh, unjaded, bright yellow protective beam, installed to replace the one tormented by years of violence. Department of Transportation positioned new height warning signs. Still, the bridge is more than a foot below standard overpass height. Homan says, "You know, there are multiple signs. There are literally flashing lights that tell you you're about to strike the bridge. We can't really do anything about it because, again, it's not our bridge." 3 weeks after the 2019 renovation, an Idealese box truck hit the beam and lost a piece of its roof. Driver 1 stated he was new to the area, was distracted by the GPS navigation unit, did not see either of the overheight signs of the road, did not see the LED and flashing sign he was overheight, and crashed into the iron rail protecting actual railroad bridge. Drivers on Gregson heading toward the underpass are inundated by warnings of their impending doom, but some still crash in the bridge. How can that be? The problem is not unique to the can opener. Traffic sign experts and traffic engineers from across the globe are baffled and intrigued by this question of road sign efficacy. A 1988 study published by Robert Duer, Criteria for the Design and Evaluation of Traffic Sign Symbols, explores various aspects of why signs work and don't work. Duer's careful analysis found understandability and conspicuity to be the most valuable aspects of effective signaling. The report leaves a reader thinking that a combo like over height must turn, surrounded by flashing lights and accented with clearly noted height requirements, might persuade drivers not to crash into a railroad bridge, but apparently not. Dutch traffic engineer Hans Moderman writes that signs aren't flawed, we just have too many of them. Moderman believes that drivers have become numb to the forest of signs on many roads. They just tune them out. For clarity, look no further than a paper whose title seems to be Cognitive Workload Itself. Look no further than Drivers' cognitive workload and driving performance under traffic sign information exposure in complex environments, a case study of the highways in China. It, too, makes the point that drivers are overloaded with stimuli and can't process all the signs they see. Indeed, I noticed that many of the can opener's victims are Penske or other rental trucks. That suggests the drivers might be unfamiliar with their trucks, unaware of their clearance, and don't realize they need to be on the lookout for overheight signs. Hen, resident 11 foot 8, now plus 8 expert, had some different ideas. He says, I think people are just distracted. They don't expect it. It sneaks up on them a little bit. He said in an interview with the Ninth Street Journal, and the location is a little tricky because it's a two-lane, one-way road between two relatively tall buildings, so the approach is really narrow. On top of that, drivers are often speeding on this road. The speed limit is 25 miles an hour. An impact at that speed would not cause bullet category damage. If you haven't been paying attention to the signs, you won't catch the bridge, and by that time, you're on it, he said. Vehicle number one collided with a low bridge protection pillar, damaging the top of the box truck. The pillar protects the railroad bridge. To watch more than 160 of these collision videos is to understand the modern limits of onomatopoeia. Somewhere around video number 30, start to tire of the intrigue. Watching them is to realize, too, how few verbs there really are to describe the length, magnitude, and velocity of a large truck unknowingly stopped by a steel beam. Collide, used often in the police reports of the incident, seems to forget that the tops of these trucks are flayed effortlessly. Smash ignores the delicate niche of the truck's cab gliding into the bridge, only to be harangued back by the bar's unsympathetic disposition. Hit is useless. I looked up synonyms for decapitate. I tried to be precise in my description, but found the terms of local trucking were a bit baffling. In the case of the box truck, stout or extended, the structure tends to be made up of dry freight aluminum sheeting with a heavy-duty metal frame or fiberglass-reinforced plywood, according to a U.S. truck body brochure. Both styles are adorned with an aluminum Zephyr front nose and corner castings. This seems to be the place that sustains the can opener's initial blow, but the beam is not discriminating in its victims, and box varieties are not the only overpass underpasses with battle scars. Many campers will find themselves sweating in the summer months as their RV's air conditioning units get plucked off by the beam. One trailer carrying a stable's worth of hay lost two bales from the top of the pile to the beam, and trailers alike often find themselves stacked too high for the bridge's liking. The worst crashes look horrible. The top is guillotined with a swift but abrasive punch. In some cases, the roofing is rolled off with precision, like those fancy ice cream places that take a scoop and turn it into a tube. Depending then on the extent of the damage to the top, the sides begin to give. If the beam intersects at the right angle, the sides somehow mangle from the get-go, and the whole truck box suffers a rupture. Every now and then, a driver is able to escape. When November 18-wheeler's victim moved forward after its sneak approached, the cab bounced under the beam with a snap and a pop. Thinking quickly, the driver dropped the air suspension and backed out to avoid further damage. After careful extraction, his box attachment escaped unscathed, and the can opener was left hungry. Our cover article, written by Leila Khoury-Hanold, concerns Ashley Christensen. We've read several articles about Ms. Christensen over the years. Path of Most Resilience. Ashley Christensen is looking forward. On the verge of opening a new restaurant chain, BB's Crispy Chicken, and navigating what one hopes is the tail end of a brutal year for the restaurant industry, the nationally lauded James Beard Award-winning chef took her share of lumps in 2020. but she's implementing changes to her company, AC Restaurants, that she owns with Caitlin Golan, her wife and ACR's executive director, that she hopes will help her forge a new, more equitable, more sustainable path forward. She said in an April phone interview with Indy, "This pandemic has exposed the extreme vulnerability of this industry. It's time for restaurants to really step up and do what it takes to be less vulnerable to moments like this. And with that, we end up with a lot more security for our people, for all the people. Just thinking about how many restaurant dollars go back into our economy and to our supply chain, it's a big deal." It is a big deal. And it has been an unimaginable year of loss for restaurants and their workers. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, more than 1.8 million restaurant and bar workers have lost their jobs since the start of the pandemic. And per the National Restaurant Association, more than 110,000 restaurants have closed. It's also been one of difficult lessons as national social justice reckonings further exposed systemic fault lines endemic to the service industry. As many restaurant owners pick up the pieces and try to move on, there are pressing questions. What might a safer, more secure future look like, and who will it protect? Christensen has been spared neither conflict nor loss in 2020. Last spring, she and Golan faced the devastating task of furloughing and laying off most of ACR's nearly 300 employees while trying to pivot and keep the operation afloat. Ultimately, they closed Chuck's, their downtown Raleigh burger joint, and at the height of the fallout that consumed downtown Raleigh restaurants Bidamanda and Brewery Bavana, ACR also came under scrutiny last summer when a former Pool's Diner employee brought forward accounts of sexual assault that she alleged happened during her employment at 2017. In response, Christensen and Golan wrote an open letter of apology to the employee who said she felt her experience had been mishandled. Christensen said she was unaware of the extent of the problems that existed at Pool's Diner, but she's been doing the work to make the work experience at her restaurants better. In 2016, ACR hired a human resource director. A new organizational infrastructure helped to create what Christensen and Golan referred to as the feedback loop, which has facilitated communication between managers and employees. ACR also utilizes OPUS, a multilingual text-based app so that non-native English-speaking employees can access paid training on human resource guidelines. And while a divide between restaurants' front-of-house and back-of-house staff, marked by a wage disparity in which servers typically make much more than their kitchen counterparts, is standard, Christensen piloted a tip pooling model at her downtown pizza restaurant, Poolside Pies, in 2019 to help address the disparity. Instead of the $2.13 servers are normally paid and expected to subsidize with tips, they start out paid the minimum wage, $7.25 an hour. Tips are shared among all employees, a model that Christensen will bring to BB's as well. But compensation is only one piece of creating a better workplace. According to Mental Health America's annual workplace reports, the food and beverage industry constantly ranks as one of the unhealthiest work environments due to the long hours, difficulty in taking time off, and high rates of substance and alcohol abuse. When Death and Taxes opened in 2015, ACR did so without its shift drink policy, a common practice and perceived job perk offering employees a free alcoholic beverage after their shift. Since then, ACR has implemented this policy across the board at the rest of its restaurants. This reflects a growing trend among restaurateurs, including Chef Scott Crawford, who eliminated staff consumption of alcohol in the workplace in 2019. And at the start of 2020, ACR enrolled all its employees in an emergency assistance program, which provides free services such as counseling sessions and financial education services, anonymously. ACR has also retooled its paid time off policies, which were previously in place only for company managers. Now, all ACR hourly employees receive 3 days of paid sick leave plus bereavement time. Additionally, the company will close for a full week in August. Golan says, "For a company of our size, it takes a lot to fully close. But we knew coming into reopening and after everything our team has been through together that we would need that time." Opening BB's gave Christensen and Golan a chance to rethink aspects of ACR's model too, they say, and build a different kind of outpost. Restaurants operate on notoriously thin margins. And in the case of higher-end sit-down service restaurants like Poole's Diner, Death and Taxes, the business model is based on maximizing diners in seats. The fast food model is built on volume. And Christensen sees BB's, a fast service concept with an inviting dining room and a product that lends itself to both dine-in and takeout, as an additional revenue stream that will help create financial sustainability and an opportunity to reinvest in the company. She says part of the appeal was taking an idea and concept and creating more accessibility. It's an interesting way to reach more communities with what I view as a very accessible product and to not tax the focus of the company we grew in service to downtown Raleigh. Although BB's menu pricing isn't finalized yet, the basic chicken sandwich will sell for approximately $6. The first BB location in Raleigh's Midtown East will open in June, followed by Durham University's Hill and Cary's Parkside Town Commons locations. But the notion of accessibility doesn't apply only to the consumer. Christensen says, "Downtown restaurants had so many employees coming from communities that now we're popping BBs up in. That was one of the barriers of entry to working downtown, much like bringing that food to the communities who have asked for years, when will you open something out here? We're also bringing those jobs to those places." When she began developing BB's menu, creating a fried chicken sandwich that was delicious, fresh, and crispy was paramount. But she wanted to simplify the cooking process to broaden employment prospects for workers who may lack formal training in cooking. She says the concept of BB's is by design built to withstand a pandemic. There's much more opportunity at BB's than in the majority of concepts we have in downtown. Streamlining the cooking process also facilitates BB's cross-training structure, in which a cashier will know how to make a chicken sandwich and a line cook can learn customer service skills. Christensen says cross-training is a way to bridge the front and back of house divide, explaining, "The goal at BB's is for every person in that building to know how to do all the jobs considered hourly jobs, and the tip pool will be shared with all hourly people. Employees will achieve a much higher hourly rate than what is maybe considered standard in fast food and in restaurants in general. This also helps create sustainability and stability for hourly food service employees who often work multiple jobs to earn a living wage." Christensen concludes, "I have always loved the access to entry that this industry provides. We are at a pivotal moment where we can provide a path to a healthy, balanced, sustainable, financially equitable, and fulfilling career experience. BB's was designed parallel to everything we desired to tune up at ACR, so it benefits from nearly 14 years of hard-earned experience. I'm beyond excited to open the doors of these buildings, old and new. They represent so much more than the physical gesture." Well, who wouldn't love a lovely story about beer? Food and Drink by Jean Paradiso. Something's always brewing. Conventional wisdom holds that brewing beer is a healthy blend of art and science. Ask enough industry pros and you'll learn that good beer is the result of consistent, repetitive procedures. You have to hit your numbers and maintain a sanitary brewing environment. But to the romantics in craft beer, the process is boundless creativity. A brewer is the ultimate experimenter, an alchemist crafting beautiful flavor combinations. The truth is somewhere in the middle, a marriage of curiosity and calculation. Few folks in the North Carolina craft beer scene embody that balance more than Whit Baker, the co-founder of the Triangle Area Bond Brothers Beer Company, Ancillary Fermentation, and most recently Standard Beer Plus Food. Baker is deeply passionate about beer and tuned into that inner balance of science and art. Like many professional brewers, Baker discovered his love of brewing as an amateur home brewer. His day job at the time was as a chemistry teacher at the Durham School of the Arts. As he developed his skills as a home brewer, he sought more knowledge, more certifications, and, importantly, more feedback. He says with a laugh, "The only way you know how to make good beer is a lot of bad beer. Everybody who is good at something has messed things up prior to being good." Ultimately, Baker's dedication led him to his first project. Though he had applied to several breweries, he hadn't landed a job in the industry. He says, "I definitely didn't know what I know now, but I knew what I was talking about. I was credible." In fact, Baker improved his homebrewing skills alongside Jeremy Bond, one of the eponymous Bond brothers. That connection led to the founding team of Bond Brothers Beer Company meeting at a homebrew party. They stayed in touch, with Baker even judging a homebrew competition hosted by eventual co-founder Andy Schnitzer. As cliche as it might be, the question, "Should we start a brewery?" was thrown around, and the answer was an emphatic yes. After launching Bond in the spring of 2016, Baker settled into his role as brewmaster, maintaining creative control of the beer lineup. Here, he progressed his brewing knowledge and earned an advanced Cicerone certification. With a profound understanding for brewing science and an eye for experimentation, Baker built a traditional portfolio backed by unique creative beers. On the well-known beer review site Untappd, Bond Brothers' most popular beer is a straightforward IPA with rotating hops. But its top-rated beer, a pastry stout collaboration brewed with peanuts, cacao, vanilla, and salt. Several years later, Baker sought a new challenge. It began with Ancillary Fermentation, a rotating beer pop-up series where each beer complemented the events. The project emphasizes experience over product, though the beer is pretty great too. Most recently, Baker launched Standard Beer Plus Food, a Raleigh brew pub that focuses on local, low-intervention products and creative food and beer pairings. He recalls, "Bond was the first venture, and we were going to do a little bit of everything. The other projects have been about creative restraints. What's fun for me is working inside those boxes." At the center of each of these projects is quality beer. Within the first few sentences of talking with Baker, you'll start hearing jargon. Friends joke that drinking beer with Baker is kind of a pain. He'll detect the off flavors or defects in a mediocre beer, or he'll be able to pinpoint the process that makes an excellent beer so special, like a magician revealing their own tricks. He explains, "The most artistic beers you've had typically end up mind-blowingly scientific, and if you ask them how they made it, it's like, I hit those numbers." But Baker isn't pedantic, and he doesn't talk down to anyone. Science just happens to be his first language. "I definitely talk more about science in person because I'm really into beer and I'm fairly well certified in beer. The base of it is science. You have to nail the science. Once you nail the science, you're then able to move on to the art part. Even after launching three projects, Baker isn't satisfied. There are always improvements to be made, new creative frontiers to cross. "My brewer's philosophy is you're only as good as your last beer that you made, and your restraints are only what you can think of." The team at Bond Brothers is launching a new Cary location, Bond Brothers East Side, which will incorporate live music from open nights to concerts into the craft beer experience. Through Ancillary's fermentations, in-person events have been put on hold due to the pandemic. Baker and his team are seeking a tap room to find a permanent home for the creative project. Standard, which opened its doors in late 2020, is still finalizing its food program. Baker says, when our menu's nailed down, I'll be modifying the beer recipes to match the kitchen more. Like an executive chef who no longer works in the kitchen, Baker is rarely in the brewhouse anymore. Rather, he leads the creative direction and works with a talented brew staff to dial in recipes and construct consistent quality beers. I was surprised, though, to learn he still home brews regularly. How does he find the time? I have no idea. But if nothing else, Baker is a man obsessed with perfecting his craft. Well, I have only a couple minutes, and I can only tease you with this art article about Midway, a vintage block keeping the spirit of Old Chapel Hill alive downtown. Brian Howe wrote it, and it's just the first couple paragraphs. Follow the setting sun down Franklin Street, and you'll find the shift as you pass the restaurant Mint. The businesses get cooler and funkier with richer lower local terroir, and art spills into the street. There's the historic music venue, Local 506, and the art space above it, Attic 506. There's Beer Study, Sid's Hair Shop, Rumors Boutique, and the venerable Italian Pizzeria 3. It's almost like traveling back to a time before Target and the Greenbridge condos, as if you could stroll into the Record Exchange or Pepper's Pizza or Second Foundation, hearing the phantom strains of the street musicians in front of First Citizens Bank. The spell lasts all the way to the Baxter, the bar arcade around the corner on Graham Street, but then, alas, like Orpheus, you turn around and Old Chapel Hill shimmers away. Aside from valiant artifacts, it's prefab chains all the way to Moorhead Planetarium. The vintage block is called Midway, and it's largely the vision of Wendy Mann, who grew up in Chapel Hill in the 70s and 80s before plunging into the art and nightclub world from L.A. to New York. Returning years later to find her hometown much changed, she had a vision that was steeped in nostalgia but tempered by worldly experience. Well, my worldly experience is telling me that my clock's going to run out and that our musicians will crash into the ending chord, closing this week's Indie Week. And you can find it in our podcast section all week at ncreadingservice.org. So for this week, John Federson says, thanks for listening. So long.